Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
There can be no going back on the democratic transition called for by the Egyptian people.
The United States stands firmly behind the democratic process.
A Clinton-Kerry handoff now seems likely at the State Department. Brian Lehrer with you on WNYC. Hello again, everybody. To watch the political TV shows, by the way, some pundits already seem anxious to say an Obama-Clinton handoff seems likely at the White House. But whoa, Nelly, first things first, what is Hillary Clinton's record as Secretary of State, and what kind of top diplomat is John Kerry, now nominated to succeed her, likely to make? David Sanger is here, the New York Times chief Washington correspondent and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Hi, David. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Great to be back with you, Brian.
And I should mention to everybody that David Sanger is joining us from Istanbul today. If he seems to be pausing a little bit after my questions, it is not out of uncertainty or being taken aback at my words necessarily, but maybe just a little eensy bit of delay on the phone line from Istanbul. So, David, let me start here. Does Secretary Clinton play a key role in your book on Obama's surprising use of American power?
Well, she does, but it's interesting that Secretary Clinton chose her shots very carefully. She was very active on the early decisions in Afghanistan, and you may recall that she played a very big role, along with then-Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, in urging the president to do a big surge in Afghanistan, something he later regretted a bit. She played another very large role in getting the United States into Libya, an operation that worked very well. In fact, her instincts on that were probably, in the end, better than the president's. And she played a very cautionary role in things like the transition in Egypt, which you just heard a bit of in that clip. You know, she said to me at one point when I was interviewing her in January of this year, as I was trying to close up, confront, and conceal, she said to me, "I told the president that I thought everything would work out fine in Egypt, but it might take 20 or 25 years."
Huh.
And she very much feared that the first stage in Egypt's next act would be the rise of the Muslim Brotherhood. She had that right.
So you would say that in the case of both Afghanistan and Libya, in both of these military situations, she influenced the president in a hawkish direction.
Absolutely. And particularly in Libya, this was a case where she and Susan Rice, we think was the president's likely first choice for Secretary of State, both pushed him to act on what's called in the foreign policy world the responsibility to protect. In other words, to step in and protect people against a leader who was abusing them, in that case, killing them. He followed their direction, although he did so with some hesitance and insisted that no Americans be put on the ground. And the result of this, I think, was that they helped speed the ouster of Muammar Gaddafi. But when it came to Syria, she was much more hesitant and recognized it was a much more volatile and dangerous situation in which the U.S. had less leverage, couldn't act from the air. And in the case of Syria, she and the rest of the administration have held back, held back too long.
And with respect to Egypt and what you were saying about how much caution she felt with respect to that situation, was she in a camp that was telling the president to go slow on recognizing the pro-democracy movement and kind of sticking with Mubarak, even though he was a dictator and all of that, because he was pro-U.S.?
Well, she was certainly hesitant about what would come next. And her basic message to the president was, you don't want to throw Mubarak under the bus until you figured out what's going to succeed him. Now, as it turned out, that was fairly early on in the debate, As it turned out, Mubarak threw himself under the bus by refusing to listen to the protesters, by telling the president he knew how to handle this, which was basically to just go out and shoot them the way President Nasser had 30 years before. He explicitly referred to another uprising against one of his predecessors. And so over time, I think that Secretary Clinton recognized there was no other choice. But she was also extraordinarily frustrated with the students who had led the democracy movement. She went out to Egypt, was one of the first senior American officials to visit and to sit down with the Tahrir Square students, and basically said to them, you guys have blown your chance. You failed to organize a party. And what you've done is just paved the way for the Muslim Brotherhood to come in. And they sort of looked at her blankly and said, well, it was our job to oust the old government, not to bring in a new one. And I think that she felt very much that they lacked any political sense.
That's an amazing story. I had not heard that before. So when you put all these things together, Egypt, Syria, Libya, Afghanistan, just the things we've discussed so far, is there anything that you would call a Clinton doctrine on foreign policy that's separate from an Obama doctrine?
Well, the Obama doctrine and the Clinton doctrine have been pretty close. And as I describe in the book, if you wanted to define an Obama doctrine, it is that the United States will act unilaterally in its own direct interests, think the bin Laden raid, for example, but it will only act in concert with neighbors and with the neighbors putting a lot of skin in the game, or allies, in the case where the U.S. only has a tangential interest. Libya was an interesting example of this, and Secretary Clinton, when she participated in these debates, was doing so from Paris and from the Middle East because she was trying to make sure that the Arab states understood that they and NATO had to take the lead and organize that. And I think that she helped sort of formulate the Obama doctrine in that regard. And in the case of Syria, they've all failed to take the lead, and I think that's been somewhat frustrating to her. And I think it's part of the reason you've seen the Obama doctrine sort of hit the wall a bit in the case of Syria. You know, it's also interesting to see those areas where Secretary Clinton was not as active. She would go to Pakistan and promote the kind of entrepreneurial work done by women in the villages and so forth. But you never saw her finger particularly in the Pakistan nuclear issues, or you never saw her take a very direct role in dealing with the army, which really runs Pakistan. Similarly with China, you saw a very active Assistant Secretary of State who worked under her, Kurt Campbell. But frequently the China meetings were taken by Tom Donilon, who's the National Security Advisor. And there was a bit of dividing up between the White House and the National Security Council and Secretary Clinton. Now, you could argue that that's the way it's got to be because the secretary can only be in so many places at one time.
My guest on WNYC is David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for The New York Times and author of the book Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. And with David, we're assessing Secretary Hillary Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State as she gets ready to step down, and what kind of Secretary of State John Kerry is likely to make to succeed her. Let me play global roulette a little bit here, David, and ask you about the Clinton legacy and different aspects of her job as Secretary of State in some other parts of the world. China. The complex relationship with China economically and China as an expanding military power in Asia. Is there a Clinton approach or Clinton record on China?
She was the one who stepped up during one of the critical meetings of the rest of the Asian powers and confronted the Chinese on their increasing claims in the South China Sea. And they were somewhat shocked that she brought it up and brought it up so bluntly. But she always maintained, as have other members of the administration, that the Chinese, who had spent 2009 cooperating with the U.S. pretty effectively on the global financial crisis, ended up alienating many of their Asian allies by their claims in the South China Sea. And the result was that they drove a lot of countries into America's arms, countries that were trying to decide, should they sign up with the Chinese or sign up with the Americans? And in In this case, I think that she handled it fairly deftly, but it is certainly an unfinished story as she leaves her job, because the Chinese are just now reassessing the degree to which they want to stake out claims that would essentially seek to push the U.S. further and further out, sort of behind the second island chain in the Pacific. And that's been a big concern of hers.
And how about Russia? We have a new tiff with them even now, with the U.S. pushing a human rights agenda and Russia cutting off U.S. adoptions of Russian orphans in response. What about that and Clinton's role?
You know, she was fairly active at the beginning of the administration in pushing for the Russian reset. Well, the reset never really happened, and now they are in the position of having to reset the reset. I think that Secretary Clinton, when she's out of office for a while and looks back at the successes and failures of the first term, would probably say that in the case of Russia, there was too much optimism early on that Russia really was fundamentally changing, and that as now President Putin prepared to come back in from the prime ministership and come in and take power again, American influence there did less and less good.
And what about human rights? Or let me start with women's rights as an aspect of human rights. Back when she was First Lady, people will remember she was considered a force for global standards of women's equality. Was that in any way front and center in her job as Secretary of State?
I wouldn't say it was front and center. It became more important toward the end as these issues came up again in the Arab Spring. But she is first and foremost a realist, and it was somewhat striking on her first trip to China that she acknowledged just about openly to the press and certainly to her aides that human rights would not be the number one issue on the agenda with the Chinese. There was simply too much else in the world of trade, in the world of military competition, in the world of global warming and so forth, to go spend a lot of energy on something where she didn't think she was going to move the Chinese leadership very much. Now, they had to change that later on when there were some prominent cases of dissidents, including one who briefly hid out in the American embassy in Beijing. But early on, it was not a big theme of hers. And I'll be interested when she gets to her memoirs, if she does do a memoir of her time as Secretary of State, about whether this is a regret, because she was certainly far more vocal on these issues when she was First Lady, showed up at a very major women's conference in Beijing, gave a pretty notable speech at that time. You didn't hear as much of that during the time that she was Secretary.
What about other human rights and elsewhere than China?
Well, she's been a little bit more active on these issues in Africa. She's been a bit more active on these issues, particularly in places like the Middle East, as you have seen some of these countries struggle through the question of what kind of democracy they would go pursue. And in Egypt, this has been particularly difficult for them, because while they were pressing for democratic elections, they ended up with a pretty more hardline Islamic government than they would care for. The same has happened in several other countries throughout the Middle East as well. And that has put two elements of the Clinton priorities at odds with each other. One of them is a continuing press for human rights. The other was for democratic elections. And sometimes you democratically elect a government that is not going to make human rights anywhere near a significant priority, or women's rights in particular.
And what about Benghazi? She managed to duck that congressional hearing last week after her illness and her fall. And I'm sure as Secretary of State, she feels, you know, overwhelmingly sad and horrible about the death of Christopher Stevens in the consulate in Benghazi and those other Americans there. But how much of the report released last week blamed her, and how much do you think this is a black mark on her tenure as Secretary of State?
Well, I certainly think it was to some degree. And when you read that report last week, what you got was a sense of a State Department that didn't react to these threats anywhere nearly as quickly or as well as they needed to. Not the immediate threat that evening of the attack in Libya on Chris Stevens. By that time, it was a bit too late, and the American military was too far away. But the report was very harshly critical of how the State Department handled the overall question of embassy security in places where there really was no government to go support a security effort for the embassies. You know, for decades and decades, we have relied on the host governments to protect our diplomats abroad. And I think if there was one overwhelming message from this report, it's that as we began to be a bigger and bigger presence in countries that had no effective government, Libya first among them, but you could also name Somalia there and several others, that we did not adjust, the secretary didn't adjust, a protective scheme that would make up for the fact that these host governments were largely incapable. And I think that when historians are looking back at the secretary's time, that's probably an area where they're going to be pretty critical. She was not directly named in the report, but she certainly said she takes responsibility for it, and I think there's no question that she should.
We're talking to David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and author of the book Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. We're talking to him at this moment of likely handoff from Hillary Clinton to John Kerry as Secretary of State. So let's turn the page and project for a few minutes. And we spent most of our time on Hillary since she's got the four-year record now. So let's spend the last few minutes to project briefly what kind of Secretary of State John Kerry might be, presuming that he's confirmed. And first, do you see any areas of policy disagreement between Kerry and Clinton? Anything he might be looking to change as far as you know?
Well, I do see one that's going to be a very interesting issue as John Kerry intersects with the rest of the administration. He is somebody who was, as you know, deeply critical of the Iraq War. His time, his testimony as a just-returned Vietnam veteran was always one of the defining issues of his political life and became a big issue when he ran in 2004 against George Bush with the Democratic presidential nomination. And I suspect that you are going to see John Kerry have to go walk this very fine line on Iraq, where Secretary Clinton has always been significantly more hawkish, has made the point sometimes more strongly than President Obama has, that everything's on the table, including the use of force, because she believes that if that isn't on the table, you're not going to reach a diplomatic solution. I'm not entirely sure how John Kerry is going to phrase his discussion of possible use of force in the case of Iran. Certainly, Secretary Clinton was deeply involved in, or at least knowledgeable of, and helped put together the policy that had sanctions on the one hand, and then covert action, including Olympic Games, which I described in the book. That's the code word that was used for the cyber war against the Iranian nuclear facilities. It's going to be interesting to see if we learn it, and who knows if we will, whether John Kerry is going to be as forceful an advocate of using all instruments of power, including covert instruments of power against Iran, to avoid an open conflict.
Which is to say, in general, he comes in a little more dovish than Hillary Clinton turned out to be.
But, you know, he's often said he's been to war, seen what it was like, and understands why it's got to be avoided at all costs. And certainly he thought the American intervention in Iraq was a huge mistake. He's been a big supporter of President Obama in pulling out of Iraq and a big supporter of President Obama in speeding the withdrawal from Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
For Secretary Clinton, as I said at the beginning, she was an early enthusiast of doing the surge in Afghanistan because she thought we needed a fair number of American troops there in order to protect the diplomats who she hoped to send in a diplomatic surge.
Mm-hmm.
I would doubt that you would see John Kerry be anywhere near as enthusiastic about keeping a significant American military presence in Afghanistan.
Yeah, sounds right. And how about Kerry's style? I had a guest this month who said he wished it was going to be Susan Rice because she's blunter and likely to be tougher with countries like China, whereas Kerry might lean toward being too companionate with countries we're trying to get to change their ways. Do you share that comparison?
Well, certainly it's true that Ambassador Rice is a much more blunt-speaking person than Senator Kerry is. The question is, which is the most effective way to deal with other countries? In the context of the United Nations Security Council, bluntness takes you a long way because those are people who work with each other each and every day, understand each other, and you can speak more bluntly and more candidly without fearing the repercussions. I think there are a lot of people, including in the State Department, who are wondering whether or not Ambassador Rice's style would translate as well if she was Secretary of State. Senator Kerry is more diplomatic in his public conversation. What's interesting about Senator Kerry is that he was sent off on many missions for President Obama, where he could move in much more quietly and spend time, as he did, say, with President Karzai of Afghanistan right after Karzai stole the presidential election in 2009. I don't know if you remember this, and it looked for a while as if Karzai would not allow a second round of voting to go on.
Right.
And they sent Kerry to basically explain to him, sometimes you have to do that, sir. And that seemed to work. He has been sent on many missions to Pakistan, including the first high-level mission to Pakistan after bin Laden was killed, and has had some pretty blunt conversations with General Kiani, who was the chief of staff. So it's hard to tell whether or not what you see in public from John Kerry is the same as what you would see in private from him.
I guess to finish up the Hillary thought, if she is going to run for president in 2016, her tenure as Secretary of State probably enhanced her stature because she seems more qualified than even before as someone who could be commander-in-chief and leader of the free world and those kinds of phrases that get placed on the president of the United States. Would you put it in any other political context?
Well, I think there are two things to think about from how her position has changed from 4 years ago. First of all, I think you identified the right one, Brian, that she now has far more experience in American foreign policy than any other of the potential candidates, with the possible exception of Joe Biden, the vice president, who's also been very active in foreign policy, sometimes disagreed with Secretary Clinton, and, of course, was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee before Senator Kerry was. The second thing is that one of the big issues that haunted her during the 2008 election was the whole health care debate back from her husband's administration. Well, that has now been so overtaken by events because of Obamacare, something that she had no role in because as Secretary of State she had to stay out of it. So I think that one of the big debating points about her has been removed, and I think that, she clearly, if she decided to enter the race, it would be hard to point to any other Democrat other than Biden who could challenge her on foreign policy. And I just kept noting that, you know, she's got this politician's incredible knowledge of names. She would know people way down deep into a foreign government's bureaucracy. And, you know, she always seemed to be enjoying the job, I would say, until the past 6 months when she looked pretty exhausted. But she put a lot of miles on the plane doing this job.
Before you go, I know you're speaking to us from Istanbul, Turkey. Are you there reporting on something, or do they just have a great New Year's Eve party somewhere?
Well, I'm sure they have a great New Year's Eve party, and I'm not invited. But, you know, usually, Brian, in my life, I fly into a place and end up reporting so hard I never get a chance to go look around. So this time I took the family, and we're all looking around, and that's all we're doing. I'm not doing any reporting. And, boy, are we having a great time.
That's good. I'm glad to hear. By the way, Hillary's okay, as far as you know, right? Nothing serious after that flu and concussion, as opposed to it just being a flu and a concussion?
I assume so, but we don't know a huge amount about what happened. Her doctors have not said very much other than she hit her head pretty hard. She missed a number of events that you wouldn't normally expect her to miss, so she must have been set back in a fairly big way. But I'm told by her aides that she's back up reading and working and on the phone and so forth and so on. So I assume after the new year that she will reappear. But the fact of the matter is, we don't know very much about what happened. I've not heard anything to suggest it was anything permanent, but it did sound scary.
Well, I don't recommend that she return to the linebacker position with the New York Jets that some people wanted her to take. But anyway, David Sanger, New York Times chief Washington correspondent and author of Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. Really, really interesting. David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brian. Happy New Year.